Elaine, whose memory had just recently been fresh in everybody's mind, quite a number of cases of infidelity, the infidelity of modern wives, occurred to Karenin. Daryalov, Poltavsky, Prince Karibanov, Count Paskudin, Dram, yes, even Dram, that honest, business-like fellow. Semyonov, Chagin, Sigonin, he passed them in review. It's true a kind of unreasonable ridicule falls on these men, but I never could see it in any other light than as a misfortune, and felt nothing but sympathy, Karenin reflected, though it was not true. He had never felt any sympathy of the kind, and the more cases he had come across of husbands being betrayed by their wives, the better the opinion he had had of himself. It is a misfortune that may befall anyone, and it has befallen me. The only question is how best to face the situation. And he began mentally reviewing the courses pursued by other men in similar positions. Daryalov fought a duel. In his youth, Karenin had been particularly attracted by the idea of dueling, just because he was physically a timid man and was quite aware of it. He could not think without horror of a pistol being levelled at him, and had never used any kind of weapon. This horror had, in his youth, often induced him to take mental measure of his strength, in case he should ever be confronted by a situation in which it would be necessary to face danger. Since, however, he had achieved success and gained a firm position in the world, he had long forgotten that feeling. But the old habit now revived and claimed its own, and the fear of being a coward was again so strong that he considered this point a long time and flattered his vanity with the idea of a duel, though he knew beforehand that he would on no account fight one. Of course, our society is still so uncivilized, not as in England, that very many, among the many were those whose opinion Karenin particularly valued, would regard a duel as the right thing. But what object would be gained? Supposing I challenged him, continued Karenin, and vividly picturing to himself the night he would spend after the challenge and the sensation of having a pistol pointed at him, he shuddered and realized he would never do it. Supposing, he went on, they showed me how to do it, placed me, and I pulled the trigger. He closed his eyes, and it turned out that I had killed him. And he shook his head to drive away the stupid thought. What sense is there in killing a man in order to define one's relations with a guilty wife and a son? Nevertheless, I shall have to decide what to do with her. But what is even more likely and sure to happen is that I should be killed or wounded. Then I, an innocent man, should be the victim. That would be still more senseless. And this is not all. A challenge from me would not be an honest action. Do I not know beforehand that my friends would never allow me to go so far as to fight a duel, would not allow a statesman whom Russia needs to expose himself to danger? What then would happen? This would happen. I, knowing beforehand that matters would never be allowed to reach a dangerous point, should have challenged a man in order to cover myself with false glamour. That would be dishonest. It would be false. It would be deceiving myself as well as others. No. A duel is unthinkable, and no one expects it of me. My aim is to safeguard my reputation, which I need for the uninterrupted pursuit of my career. His official pursuits, which had always appeared essential to Karenin, now assumed even greater importance. Having considered and rejected the idea of a duel, Karenin turned his thoughts to divorce, the next expedient of which some of the wronged husbands he remembered had availed themselves. Going over all the cases of divorce he knew, there were very many, and in the highest society with which he was well acquainted, Karenin could not recall one in which the purpose of the divorce was the one he had in view. In all these cases, the husband had ceded or sold the unfaithful wife, and the very person who, according to law, had no right to remarry entered into fictitious, pseudo-legal relations with a pretended husband. Karenin saw that in his own case it would be impossible to obtain a legal divorce, that is, a divorce in which the guilty wife would be simply cast off. He knew that in their complex conditions of life it would not be possible to obtain those coarse proofs of a wife's infidelity which the law demanded. He knew that in that life there was a certain convention of refinement which would not allow him to bring forward such proofs had they existed, because such an action would make him sink even lower than she in public opinion. To attempt a divorce could only lead to a lawsuit and a scandal which would give his enemies great opportunity for calumny and would lower his high position in society. The chief object of his life, the settling of conditions with the least possible amount of disturbance, could not be furthered by divorce. Besides, it was evident that as a consequence of divorce, the wife would break off relations with her husband and unite with her lover. In Karenin's soul, however, despite the complete and contemptuous indifference he thought he felt for his wife, there was one feeling left with regard to her, an objection to her being in a position to unite unhindered with Vronsky, so making her crime advantageous to her. The very thought of it irritated him to such an extent that he groaned with inner pain, rose and changed his place in the carriage, and for a long while after that he sat wrapping his fluffy rug round his bony, easily chilled legs. Besides a formal divorce, it would be possible to act as Karibanov, Paskudin, and that good-natured Dram did, and just separate, he resumed when he had grown calm again. But this measure would have all the inconvenience of a divorce scandal and would throw his wife into Vronsky's arms just in the same way. "Oh, it is impossible! Impossible!" he said aloud, again wrapping the rug round his legs. "I cannot be unhappy, but she and he must not be happy." The jealousy that had tormented him during the period of uncertainty had left him when his wife's words had, with great pain, drawn that aching tooth. But another feeling had now taken the place of the jealousy. It was a wish that his wife's guilt should meet with retribution. He did not acknowledge it to himself, but in the depths of his soul he wished her to suffer for impairing his peace of mind and his honour. And having reviewed the possibilities of a duel, of divorce, and of separation, and having again rejected them, Karenin came to the conclusion that there was only one course to be followed: to keep her with him, hiding from the world what had happened, and taking all necessary steps to put a stop to her love affair, and above all, though he did not confess this to himself, to punish her. "I must inform her of my decision, that after considering the painful situation in which she has placed her family, I think that an external status quo would be better for both parties than any other expedient, and that I am prepared to keep to that on the strict understanding on her part that she will obey my will and break off relations with her lover." In confirmation of this decision, after it had already been reached, another powerful argument occurred to Karenin. "It is only by this course that I can conform with religion," said he to himself. "It is the only way that makes it possible for me not to disown my guilty wife and to give her a chance of repenting, and even, painful as it will be, to devote part of my powers to her redemption." Though Karenin knew that he could have no moral influence on his wife, that all his attempts to redeem her would lead to nothing but lies, and although during the painful moments he had lived through he had not once thought of seeking guidance in religion, now that his decision was, as he imagined, in conformity with religion, its sanction afforded him great satisfaction, and even some comfort. It was pleasant to think that no one would have a right to say that in such an important crisis in his life he had not acted in accordance with that religion whose banner he had always held aloft amid general coldness and indifference. Proceeding to consider further details, Karenin could not even see why his relations with his wife should not remain almost the same as before. He could, of course, never again revive his respect for her. But there was no occasion for him to spoil his own life and to suffer just because she had proved a bad and unfaithful wife. Yes. Time goes on, and time, which cures everything, will restore the old conditions, said Karenin to himself. That is, it will restore them insofar that I shall not have this worry during the rest of my life. She must be unhappy. But I am not guilty, and therefore I cannot suffer. Chapter 14. By the time he reached Petersburg, Karenin had not only resolved to keep to his decision, but had mentally composed a letter to his wife. On entering the hall of his house, he glanced at the letters and papers which had been sent from the ministry and ordered them to be brought into his study. "Tell him to unharness, and no one is to be admitted," he said in answer to the hall porter's inquiry, accentuating with a certain pleasure the word "admitted." It was a sign that he was in good spirits. He paced twice up and down his study and then halted at the gigantic writing table on which his valet had already lit 6 candles. Cracking his fingers, he sat down and arranged his writing materials. With his elbow on the table and his head bent to one side, he sat and thought for a minute, and then wrote without an instant's pause. He did not begin by addressing her, and wrote in French, using the plural pronoun you, which in French does not sound as cold and distant as it does in Russian. During our last conversation, I expressed my intention of communicating my decision with reference to the subject of that conversation. Having carefully and fully considered everything, I now write to fulfill my promise. My decision is as follows. Whatever your actions may have been, I do not consider myself justified in severing the bonds with which a higher power has united us. A family must not be broken up through the caprice, perversity, or even crime of one of the married couple, and our life must go on as heretofore. This is unavoidable for my sake, for yours, and for that of our son. I am perfectly convinced that you have repented and are repenting of the action which has led to this letter, and will completely cooperate with me to eradicate the cause of our discord and to forget the past. If not, you can yourself foresee what awaits you and your son. I hope to talk all this over with you in more detail at a personal interview. As the summer season is drawing to a close, I would ask you to return to Petersburg as soon as possible, and not later than Tuesday. All necessary preparations shall be made for your return. I beg you to note that I attach importance to this request of mine. A. Karenin. P.S. I enclose some money which you may need for your expenses. He read the letter over and was satisfied with it, especially with having remembered to enclose the money. There was not a single cruel word or threat in it, yet it was not yielding in tone. Above all, it provided a golden bridge for her to return by. Having folded the letter, smoothed it out with a massive ivory paper knife and put it and the money in an envelope, with the pleasure that the use of his well-arranged writing appliances always caused him, he rang. "Give this to the messenger and tell him to take it to the country, to Anna Arkadyevna, tomorrow," he said, and got up. "Yes, Your Excellency. Shall tea be served in the study?" Karenin assented, and toying with his paper knife, went to his armchair, beside which a lamp was burning, and a French book about the Ugubin tables was lying ready. Above the armchair hung a beautifully painted portrait of Anna by a celebrated artist. To Karenin, the splendidly painted black lace on the head, the black hair, and the beautiful white hand with many rings on the third finger suggested something intolerably bold and provocative. After looking at the portrait for about a minute, he shuddered, and his lips trembled and made a sound like "brrr" as he turned away. He sat down hurriedly and opened his book. He tried to read, but could not awaken in himself the lively interest he had felt for the Yugyabin tables. His eyes were on the book, but he was thinking about something else. He was not thinking of his wife, but of a complication that had recently arisen in his official activity, and at present constituted the chief interest of his work. He felt that he now saw more deeply than ever into that complication, and that a capital idea, he might say that without flattering himself, had occurred to him which would disentangle the whole business, raise him in his official career, upset his enemies, and therefore be of the greatest value to the state. As soon as the footman who had brought in the tea had left the room, Karenin rose and went to the writing table. Drawing toward himself the portfolio of current affairs, with a scarcely perceptible smile of self-satisfaction, he took a pencil from the stand and became absorbed in reading some intricate papers he had sent for relating to the impending complication. The complication was this. Karenin's official peculiarity, his characteristic tray — every successful official has his special tray — which, together with his determined ambition, self-restraint, honesty, and self-confidence, had made him successful, consisted in a contempt for red tape, a curtailment of correspondence, economy, and, as far as possible, a direct relation with real facts. It so happened that the important committee of June the 2nd had had brought before it the question of irrigation in the Zaraisk province, which belonged to Karenin's department, and presented a striking example of unproductive expenditure and useless red tape methods. Karenin knew that this was really so. The field irrigation of the Zaraisk province had been started by the predecessor of Karenin's predecessor. A great deal of money had been and was being spent quite unproductively on that business, and it was evident that the scheme would lead to nothing. When Karenin had first taken up his present post, he had at once realized this and had wished to stop it. But till he felt himself firmly seated, he knew that it would not be wise to do so, as too many interests were involved. Afterwards, being occupied with other matters, he had simply forgotten the business. Like all such matters, it went on of itself, by inertia. Many people lived by it, especially one very moral and musical family in which the daughters all played stringed instruments. Karenin was acquainted with that family and gave away one of the daughters at her marriage. The raising of this question by a hostile department was, in Karenin's opinion, dishonest, because in every ministry there were still graver matters which, out of recognized official decency, no one ever questioned. But since the gauntlet had been thrown down, he would take it up boldly and would demand the appointment of a special committee to investigate and report upon the work of the Committee of Irrigation in the Zaraisk province, but at the same time he would not yield an inch to those gentlemen who had raised the question. He would demand the appointment of a special committee to inquire into the case of the subject races in that province. The case of the subject races had been accidentally raised at the committee of 2nd of June, and had been energetically insisted on by Karenin as a matter of urgency in view of their wretched condition. At the committee, this question had caused conflict between several ministries. The ministry opposed to Karenin had argued that the condition of the subject races was most flourishing, and that the projected rearrangement might destroy their prosperity, while, if there was really anything unsatisfactory, it all resulted from the neglect by Karenin's department of the measures prescribed by the law. Now Karenin meant to demand, first, that a new commission should be formed to investigate locally the conditions of the subject races. Secondly, should those conditions prove to be such as they appeared to be from the official reports already received, that another scientific commission should be appointed to study the causes of this deplorable condition of the subject races in the following aspects: A. Political, B. Administrative, C. Economic, D. Ethnographic, E. Material, and F. Religious. Thirdly, that information should be demanded from the hostile department concerning the measures it had taken during the last 10 years to avert the unfavourable conditions to which the subject races were now exposed. And fourthly, that the department in question should be required to explain why it had acted in direct contradiction to the meaning of the Fundamental and Organic Law, Volume Article 18 and footnote to Article 36, as appeared from the statements submitted to the committee and numbered 17015 and 18308 of 5th of December 1863 and 7th of June 1864. A flush of animation suffused Karenin's face as he rapidly wrote out a summary of these ideas. Having covered a sheet of foolscap, he rose, rang, and sent off a note to his chief secretary, asking for some necessary references that had to be looked up. After walking up and down the room, he again looked at the portrait, frowned, and smiled contemptuously. He once more took up the book on the Ugubin tables, and having reawakened an interest in them, at 11 o'clock went to bed, and when, as he lay there, he remembered what had occurred with his wife, it no longer appeared to him in such gloomy colours. Chapter 15. Though Anna had angrily and obstinately contradicted Vronsky when he said that her position was an impossible one, in the depths of her soul she felt that the situation was a false one, and wished with all her heart to put an end to it. On her way back from the races, in a moment of excitement, in spite of the pain it caused her, she had told her husband everything, and she was glad she had done so. After he left her, she told herself that she was glad she had told him that now everything would be definite, at any rate the falsehood and deception would no longer exist. She thought it quite certain that her position would be cleared up for good. Her new position might be a bad one, but it would be definite, and there would be no vagueness or falsehood. The pain she had inflicted on herself and her husband would now, she thought, be compensated for by the fact that the matter would be settled. She saw Vronsky that same evening, but did not tell him what had passed between her and her husband, though he would have to be told before her position could be settled. When she woke up in the morning, the first thing that came into her mind was what she had said to her husband, and it now appeared so terrible that she could not understand how she had been able to utter such strange and coarse words, and could not imagine what result they would have. But the words had been spoken, and Karenin had gone away without saying anything. "I saw Vronsky and did not tell him. Just as he was going away, I wished to call him back and tell him, but changed my mind, because my not having done so at first would have appeared strange. Why did I not tell him?" And in answer to this question, a hot blush of shame spread all over her face. She knew what had stopped her, knew she had been ashamed. The situation which the night before had appeared to be clearing up now seemed quite hopeless. She dreaded the disgrace which she had not considered before. When she thought of what her husband would do, the most terrible fancies came into her head. She fancied that presently the steward would come and turn her out of the house, and that her disgrace would be proclaimed to all the world. She asked herself where she would go when turned out, and found no answer. When she thought about Vronsky, she imagined that he did not love her, that he was beginning to find her a burden, and that she could not offer herself to him, and in consequence she felt hostile toward him. She felt as if the words she had used to her husband, which she kept repeating in imagination, had been said by her to everyone, and that everyone had heard them. She had not the courage to look into the eyes of the people she lived with. She could not make up her mind to call her maid, and still less to go down and face her son and his governess. The maid, who had long been listening at the door, at last came in of her own accord. Anna looked inquiringly into her eyes, and blushed with alarm. The maid begged pardon, and said she thought she had heard the bell. She brought a dress and a note. The note was from Betsy, who reminded her that she, Betsy, was that day expecting Liza Merkalova and the Baroness Stoltz with their admirers Kalutsky and old Stremov to a game of croquet. "Do come, if only to study manners and customs. I expect you," she wrote in conclusion. Anna read the note and sighed deeply. I don't want anything. Anything at all, she said to Anushka, who was moving the bottles and brushes on the dressing table. I will get dressed and come down at once. I want nothing. Nothing at all. Anushka went out, but Anna did not get dressed. She remained in the same position, with head and arms drooping. Every now and then her whole body shuddered as she tried to make some movement or to say something, and then became rigid again. Oh, my God, she kept repeating. But neither the word God or my had any meaning for her. The thought of seeking comfort in religion, though she had never doubted the truth of the religion in which she had been brought up, was as foreign to her as asking Karenin for help would have been. She knew that she could find no help in religion unless she was prepared to give up that which alone gave a meaning to her life. She was not only disturbed, but was beginning to be afraid of a new mental condition such as she had never before experienced. She felt as if everything was being doubled in her soul, just as objects appear doubled to weary eyes. Sometimes she could not tell what she feared and what she desired. Whether she feared and desired what had been or what would be, and what it was she desired, she did not know. Oh, dear, what am I doing? She said to herself suddenly, feeling pain in both sides of her head. When she came to her senses, she found that she was clutching her hair and pressing her temples with both hands. She jumped up and began pacing up and down the room. Coffee is ready, and Mamselle and Tsaretsa are waiting, said Anushka, coming in again and finding Anna in the same position. Tsaretsa? What of Tsaretsa? Anna asked, reviving suddenly, as for the first time that morning she remembered the existence of her son. It seems he's got into trouble, answered Anushka with a smile. Into trouble? How? You had some peaches in the corner room. It seems he's eaten one of them on the quiet. The thought of her son at once took Anna out of the hopeless condition she had been in. She remembered that partly sincere but greatly exaggerated role of a mother living for her son, which she had assumed during the last 5 years, and felt with joy that in the position in which she found herself, she had still one stay, independent of her relations with her husband and Vronsky. That stay was her son. Whatever position she might accept, she could not give up her son. Let her husband disgrace her, let Vronsky grow cold toward her and continue to live his own independent life. Again she thought of him with bitterness and reproach. She could not give up her son. She had an aim in life, and must act so as to ensure her position toward her son while they had not yet taken him from her. She must take him away. That was the only thing to do at present. She must be calm and escape from this terrible situation. The thought of decided action concerned with her son, of going away somewhere with him, made her feel calmer. She dressed quickly, and with determined steps entered the drawing-room, where Tsaretsa and his governess were waiting breakfast for her, as usual. Tsaretsa, dressed all in white, was standing by a table under a looking-glass and arranging some flowers he had brought with bent head and back, showing that strained attention familiar to her in which he resembled his father. His governess was looking exceptionally stern. Tsaretsa exclaimed in a piercing voice, as he often did, "Ah, Mama!" and stopped, hesitating whether to go and bid her good morning and leave the flowers, or to finish the crown he was making and take it to her. The governess began to give a long and detailed account of his misconduct, but Anna did not listen to her. She was wondering whether to take her also or not. No, I won't, she decided. I will go alone with my son. Yes, that was very wrong, said Anna, and putting her hand on his shoulder, she looked at him not with a severe, but with a timid expression which confused and gladdened the boy. She kissed him. Leave him to me, she said to the astonished governess, and still holding his hand, she sat down at the breakfast table. Mama, he said, trying to find out from her face what he was to expect for eating the peach. "Seretse," she said, as soon as the governess had gone away. "It was wrong. But you won't do it again? You love me?" She felt the tears coming into her eyes. "As if I could help loving him," she said to herself, looking into his frightened and yet happy face. "And is it possible that he would take sides with his father to torment me?" The tears were already streaming down her cheeks, and in order to hide them, she jumped up abruptly and went out onto the veranda. After the thunderstorms of the last few days, the weather had grown clear and cold. She shivered with cold, and with the terror that seized her with new power out in the open air. "Go to Mariette," she said to Seretse, who had come out after her, and she began pacing up and down the straw matting of the veranda. "Is it possible that they could not forgive me, or understand that it could not have been otherwise?" she asked herself. She stopped and looked at the crown of an aspen trembling in the wind, with its clean-washed leaves glistening brilliantly in the cold sunshine, and she felt that they would not forgive, that everybody would now be as pitiless toward her as the sky and the trees, and again she felt that duality in her soul. No, I must not think," she said to herself. "I must get ready to go." "Where? When? Whom shall I take with me?" "To Moscow?" "Yes, by the evening train, with Anushka and Seretse, and with only the most necessary things. But first I must write to both of them." She quickly went to her sitting room and wrote to her husband. "After what has happened, I can no longer remain in your house. I am going away and taking my son. I do not know the law, and therefore I do not know to which of his parents a son must be left, but I am taking him because I cannot live without him. Be generous and leave him to me." Up to that point she wrote quickly and naturally, but the appeal to his generosity, in which she did not believe, and the necessity of finishing the letter with something moving, stopped her. "I cannot speak of my fault and my repentance because..." She stopped again, unable to connect her thoughts. "No, I will say nothing," she thought, tore up the letter, rewrote it, omitting the reference to his generosity, and sealed it. The other letter she meant to write was to Vronsky. "I have informed my husband," she began, and was unable to write any more. It seemed so coarse and unwomanly. "Besides, what can I write to him?" she asked herself, and again she blushed with shame. She thought of his calmness, and a feeling of vexation with him made her tear the paper to pieces with the one sentence written on it. "There is no need to write anything," she thought, closed her blotting book, went upstairs to tell the governess and the servant that she was going to Moscow that evening, and then began packing. Chapter 16. In all the rooms of the country house, porters, gardeners, and footmen went about carrying out the things. Cupboards and chests of drawers stood open. Twice the nearest shop had been sent to for balls of string. The floor was strewn with newspapers. Two trunks, several bags, and some strapped-up rugs had been taken down to the hall. A closed carriage and two izvozchiks were waiting at the front porch. Anna, who had forgotten her agitation while she was working, stood at a table in the sitting-room packing her handbag when Anushka drew her attention to the noise of approaching carriage wheels. Anna looked out and saw Karenin's messenger in the porch ringing the bell. "Go and see what it is," she said, and, calmly prepared for anything, sat down in an easy chair and folded her hands on her knees. A footman brought her a thick envelope addressed in her husband's handwriting. "The messenger has been told to wait for an answer," he said. "All right," she replied, and as soon as he had gone, she tore open the envelope with trembling fingers. A packet of new, still unfolded notes in a paper band fell out. She unfolded the letter and read the end first. "All necessary preparations shall be made for your return. I beg you will note that I attach importance to this request of mine," she read. Having glanced through it, she went back and read it again from the beginning. When she had finished, she felt cold and knew that a more dreadful misfortune had befallen her than she had ever expected. She had that morning repented of having told her husband and wished it were possible to unsay her words. And here was a letter treating her words as unsaid and giving her what she had desired. But now the letter appeared more terrible than anything she could have imagined. "He's in the right. He's in the right," she muttered. "Of course he always is in the right. He is a Christian. He is magnanimous. Yes, a mean, horrid man. And no one but I understands or will understand it, and I cannot explain it. They say he's a religious, moral, honest, and wise man. But they do not see what I have seen. They do not know how for 8 years he has been smothering my life, smothering everything that was alive in me, that he never once thought I was a live woman in need of love. They do not know how at every step he hurt me and remained self-satisfied. Have I not tried with all my might to find a purpose in my life? Have I not tried to love him, tried to love my son, when I could no longer love my husband? But the time came when I understood that I could no longer deceive myself, that I am alive and cannot be blamed but because God made me so, that I want to love and to live. And now, if he killed me, if he had killed him, I would have borne anything, I would have forgiven anything, but no, he... How was it I did not guess what he would do? He will do what is consistent with his low nature. He will be in the right, but as for me, who am already disgraced, he will disgrace me more and more. You can yourself foresee what awaits you and your son," she repeated the words of the letter. "That is a threat that he will take my son from me, and probably their stupid laws will permit it. But don't I know why he said it? He does not believe in my love for my son, or he despises it. He always did snigger at it. He despises that feeling of mine, but he knows that I will not give up my son, that I cannot give him up, that without my son I cannot live even with the man I love, that if I forsook my son I should act like a horrid, disreputable woman. He knows that, and knows that I have not the power to do it. Our life must go on as heretofore," she recalled another sentence of the letter. "That life was painful before. Lately it had been dreadful. What will it be now? And he knows it all, knows that I cannot repent of breathing, of loving, knows that nothing but lies and deception can come of this arrangement, but he wants to continue to torture me. I know him. I know that he swims and delights in falsehood as a fish does in water. But no, I will not give him that pleasure, come what will. I will break this web of lies in which he wishes to entangle me. Anything is better than lies and deception. But how? Oh, God, was a woman ever as unhappy as I am? No, I shall break it off. Break it off," she exclaimed, jumping up and forcing back her tears. And she went to the table to write him another note, though she knew in the depths of her soul that she would not have the strength to break anything off, nor to escape from her former position, however false and dishonest it might be. She sat down at her writing table. But instead of writing, she folded her arms on the table and put her head on them and began to cry, sobbing with her whole bosom heaving, as a child cries. She wept because the hopes of clearing up and defining her position were destroyed forever. She knew beforehand that everything would remain as it was and would be even far worse than before. She felt that, insignificant as it had appeared that morning, the position she held in society was dear to her, and that she would not have the strength to change it for the degraded position of a woman who had forsaken husband and child and formed a union with her lover. That however much she tried, she could not become stronger than herself. She would never be able to feel the freedom of love, but would always be a guilty woman continually threatened with exposure, deceiving her husband for the sake of a shameful union with a man who was a stranger and independent of her, and with whom she could not live a united life. She knew that it would be so, and yet it was so terrible that she could not even imagine how it would end. And she cried without restraint, like a punished child. The approaching step of the footman recalled her to herself, and hiding her face from him, she pretended to be writing. "The messenger is asking for the answer," he said.
"The answer? Yes, let him wait. I will ring," said Anna.
"What can I write?" she thought. "What can I decide alone? What do I know? What do I want? That I am in love?"
And she felt again a schism in her soul, and again was frightened by the feeling. So she seized the first pretext for action that occurred to her to divert her thoughts from herself. "I must see Alexei," as she called Vronsky in her thoughts. "He alone can tell me what to do. I shall go to Betsy's, and perhaps shall meet him there." Quite forgetting that the evening before, when she had told him that she was not going to the Princess Verskaya's, he had replied that in that case he would not go either. She wrote to her husband, "I have received your letter, A," rang, and gave the note to the footman. "We are not going," she said to Anushka, who had just come in.
"Not going at all?"
"No, but don't unpack till tomorrow, and let the carriage wait. I am going to see the princess."
"What dress shall I put out?"
Chapter 17. The croquet match to which the Princess Verskaya had invited Anna was to be played by two ladies and their admirers. The two ladies were the chief representatives of a choice new Petersburg circle called, in imitation of an imitation of something, Les Sept Merveilles du Monde. These ladies belonged to a circle which, though higher, was entirely hostile to the set Anna frequented. Old Stremov, one of Petersburg's influential men and Liza Merkalova's adorer, was also officially hostile to Karenin. These considerations had made Anna reluctant to come, and it was to her refusal that the hints in Princess Verskaya's note had referred. But now the hope of seeing Vronsky had brought Anna. She arrived at the Princess Verskaya's house before the other visitors. Just as she arrived, Vronsky's footman, who with his well-brushed whiskers looked like a gentleman of the bedchamber, also came up. He stopped at the door, took off his cap, and let her pass. Anna saw him, and only then remembered that the evening before Vronsky had said that he was not coming. Probably he had sent a note to say so. As she was taking off her outdoor things in the hall, she heard the footman, who even pronounced his R's like a gentleman of the bedchamber, say, "From the Count to the Princess," as he delivered the note. She felt inclined to ask where his master was. She wanted to go home and write to him to come to her house, or to go to him herself. But none of these things could be done. She heard in front of her the bell that announced her arrival, and the Princess Tverskaya's footman was already standing half-turned toward her at an open door, waiting for her to enter the inner rooms.
"The Princess is in the garden. She will be informed in a minute. Will you not come into the garden?" said another footman in the next room. The feelings of irresolution and indefiniteness were just the same as at home, or even worse, because she could do nothing. She could not see Vronsky, but had to stay there, in this company of strangers, so out of sympathy with her present mood. But she wore a costume that she knew suited her. She was not alone, but surrounded by a ceremonious setting of idleness, and she felt easier than at home. She had no need to think of what to do. Everything did itself. When she met Betsy coming toward her in a white costume that struck Anna by its elegance, Anna smiled at her as usual. The Princess Tverskaya came accompanied by Tushkevich and a young girl, a relation who, to the great delight of her provincial parents, was spending the summer with the Grand Princess. There must have been something unusual about Anna's look, for Betsy noticed it at once.
"I have slept badly," answered Anna, gazing at the footman, who she guessed was bringing Vronsky's note.
"How glad I am that you have come," said Betsy.
"I am tired, and am going to have a cup of tea before they arrive. Won't you and Masha go and look at the croquet lawn, where the grass is cut?" she said to Tushkevich. "We can have a heart-to-heart talk over our tea."
"We'll have a cozy chat, won't we?" she added in English,
pressing the hand with which Anna held her sunshade.
"Yes, especially as I cannot stay long. I must go to the old Countess Vreda. I promised to, ages ago," said Anna, to whom falsehood, so alien to her by nature, had now become so simple and natural in society that it even gave her pleasure. Why she had said something she had not even thought of a moment before, she could not have explained. Her only reason for saying it was that since Vronsky was not coming, she must secure her freedom and try to see him in some other way. But why she had mentioned the old lady-in-waiting Vreda, to whom, among many other people, she owed a visit, she could not have explained. And yet, as it happened, she could have thought of nothing better had she tried to invent the most cunning means of seeing Vronsky.
"No, I won't let you go on any account," said Betsy, fixing her eyes intently on Anna. "I should be really hurt if I were not so fond of you.
It's just as if you thought my company might compromise you.
Please, bring us tea in the little drawing-room," she said to the footman, screwing up her eyes as she always did when speaking to a footman. She took the note from him and read it.
"Alexei has failed us," she said in French. "He writes that he cannot come."
She spoke in a natural and matter-of-fact tone, as if it never entered her head that Vronsky had any other interest for Anna than as a croquet player. Anna was aware that Betsy knew everything, but when she heard her talk about Vronsky, she always felt a momentary conviction that Betsy knew nothing about it.
"Ah," said Anna, in an indifferent tone, as if she cared very little about it, and went on with a smile, "how could your company compromise anyone?"
This play of words, this concealment of a secret, had a great charm for Anna, as it has for all women. It was not the necessity for secrecy, not its purpose, but the process itself that was fascinating.
"I cannot be more Catholic than the Pope," she said. "Stremov and Liza Merkalova are the cream of society. They are received everywhere, and I," she put special stress on that I, "never was severe or intolerant. I simply have not the time."
"No. Perhaps you do not want to meet Stremov?
Let him and Alexei Alexandrovich break lances at their committee meetings. That has nothing to do with us. In society, he is the most amiable man I know, and a passionate croquet player, you'll see. And in spite of his ridiculous position as Lisa's old admirer, you should see how he carries it off. He's very charming. Sappho Stoltz, you do not know? She is quite a new type."
While Betsy was saying this, Anna saw by her bright, intelligent look that she partly understood Anna's position and was devising something. They were in a small sitting-room.
"But I must write to Alexei." And Betsy sat down at the table, wrote a few words, and put the paper in an envelope. "I am writing to ask him to come to dinner. I have one lady too many. See if I have made it pressing enough. Excuse me, I must leave you for a minute. Please close the envelope and send it," she said from the doorway. "I have some orders to give."
Without thinking for an instant, Anna sat down at the table with Betsy's note, and without reading it, added at the bottom, I must see you. Come to Vreda's garden. I shall be there at 6. She closed it, and Betsy, returning, sent it off in her presence. Over their tea, which was brought them in the cool little drawing-room, the two women really had, before the arrival of the visitors, the cosy chat the Princess Tverskaya had promised Anna. They passed in review all who were expected to come, and their conversation dwelt at some length on Liza Merkalova.
She is very nice and was always attractive to me, said Anna.
You must love her. She dotes on you. Yesterday she came to me at the races and was quite in despair that she had missed you. She said that you are a real heroine for a novel, and that were she a man, she would have committed 1,000 follies for your sake. Stremov tells her she is committing them as it is.
Yes, but do tell me. I never can understand, said Anna, after a pause, in a tone that clearly proved she was not putting an idle question, and that what she was asking about was more important to her than it ought to be. Do tell me, what are her relations with Prince Kalutsky, whom they call Mishka? I have not often met them. What are they?
Betsy looked at her with smiling eyes.
It is a new fashion, she replied. They have all adopted that fashion. They have kicked over the traces, but there are different ways of doing it.
Yes, but what are her relations with Kalutsky?
Betsy burst into an unexpected, merry and uncontrollable peal of laughter, a thing she rarely did.
You are encroaching on the Princess Mayakaya's domain. That is a question an enfant terrible might put.
And Betsy evidently tried to, but could not, control herself, and again burst out into the infectious kind of laughter peculiar to those who laugh seldom.
You must ask them,
she uttered, while tears of laughter choked her voice.
It is all very well for you to laugh, said Anna, who could not help laughing too, but I never was able to understand it. I cannot understand the husband's position.
The husband's?
Liza Merkalova's husband carries her rugs after her and is always at her service.
But what there is behind it all, no one really cares to know.
Don't you know that in good society no one talks or even thinks about certain details of the toilette? It is just the same in such cases.
Will you be at Rolandaki's fete? Asked Anna, in order to change the subject.
I don't think so, answered Betsy.
And while looking at her friend, she began filling the little translucent cup with aromatic tea. She moved one of the cups toward Anna, got out a paquitos, placed it in a silver holder, and lit it.
You see, she said, I am in a lucky position. I understand you, and I understand Liza.
Liza's is one of those naive natures who, like children, are unable to understand the difference between right and wrong. At least, she did not understand it when she was very young. And now she knows that the role of not understanding becomes her. Now perhaps she is purposely ingenuous. And Betsy smiled pointedly. But still, it becomes her.
You see, a thing may be looked at tragically and turned to a torment, or looked at quite simply and even gaily.
Perhaps you are inclined to take things too tragically.
How I wish I knew others as I know myself, said Anna, seriously and thoughtfully. Am I worse than others, or better?
Worse, I think.
Enfant terrible. Enfant terrible, Betsy repeated. But here they come.
Chapter 18. Sounds of footsteps and a man's voice, then that of a woman followed by laughter, reached them, and the expected visitors entered the room. Sappho Stoltz and a young man, shining with a superabundance of health, known as Vaska. It was evident that he flourished on underdone beef, truffles, and burgundy. Vaska bowed to the ladies, only glancing at them for a second. He came into the drawing-room behind Sappho and followed her across the room as if he were tied to her, with his glittering eye fixed on her as if he were ready to eat her. Sappho Stoltz had fair hair and black eyes. She entered with a short, brisk step in shoes with high French heels and shook hands with the ladies with a firm grip like a man. Anna had never met this celebrity before, and was struck by her beauty, by the extravagant fashion of her costume, and by the boldness of her manners. On her head, the delicate golden hair, her own and others, was built up into such an erection that her head was as large as her shapely, well-developed, and much exposed bust. At each strenuous step as she advanced, the shape of her knees and thighs was distinctly visible under her dress, and one involuntarily wondered just where, behind, under her heaped and swaying bustle, the real, graceful little body ended, which was so exposed at the top and so hidden at the back and below. Betsy hastened to introduce her to Anna. "Just fancy, we nearly ran over two soldiers," she began at once, winking and smiling as she threw back her train, which she had jerked too much to one side. "I was with Vaska." "Oh, but you are not acquainted." And she introduced the young man by his surname and burst into ringing laughter at her mistake in speaking of him as Vaska to a stranger. Vaska again bowed to Anna, but said nothing. He turned to Sappho.
"You have lost the bet. We have arrived first. Pay up," he said, smiling.
Sappho laughed still more merrily.
"Surely not now," she said.
"Never mind, I will have it later."
"All right, all right. Oh, yes," she suddenly said, addressing her hostess. "I'm a nice one. I quite forgot. I have brought you a visitor. Here he is."
The unexpected young visitor Sappho had brought with her and forgotten was nevertheless so important a personage that in spite of his youth, both ladies rose to greet him. He was Sappho's new admirer, and followed at her heels, just like Vaska. Then the Prince Kaluski arrived, and Liza Merkalova with Stremov. Liza Merkalova was a slight brunette with a lazy, oriental type of face, and beautiful, everybody said unfathomable, eyes. The character of her dark costume, as Anna at once noticed and appreciated, was perfectly suited to her style of beauty. Just to the same extent as Sappho was compact and spruce, Liza was limp and pliant. But to Anna, Liza was by far the more attractive. When Betsy had spoken to Anna about her, she had said that Liza was playing the role of an ingenuous child. But when Anna saw her, she knew that this was untrue. She was really ingenuous, and a perverted but a sweet and irresponsible woman. It is true she had adopted the same tone as Sappho, and as in Sappho's case, two admirers followed her as if tied to her and devoured her with their eyes, one a young and the other an old man. But in her there was something superior to her surroundings. She had the radiance of a real diamond among false stones. This radiance shone out of her beautiful and really unfathomable eyes. The weary yet passionate look of those eyes, with the dark circles beneath them, was striking in its perfect sincerity. Looking into those eyes, everyone felt as if they knew her perfectly, and knowing her could not help loving her. At the sight of Anna, her whole face lit up with a joyful smile.
"Oh, I am pleased to see you," she said, walking up to Anna. "Yesterday at the races I was just trying to get near you when you went away. I was so anxious to see you, yesterday especially. Was it not dreadful?"
And she gave Anna a look that seemed to reveal her whole soul.
"Yes, I never thought it would be so exciting," replied Anna, blushing.
The company rose to go into the garden.
"I won't go," said Liza, smiling and sitting down beside Anna.
You won't either. Who wants to play croquet?
I like it, said Anna.
Tell me, how do you manage not to feel bored? It cheers me to look at you. You are full of life, but I am bored.
You? Bored?
Why, yours is the gayest set in Petersburg, said Anna.
It may be that those who